I have to say that I don't think I've ever before preached following a minister who has offered a prayer for our sense of humor. We're about to find out whether it took Dean Randolph. Today, at the gate of a new year of grace, we are also brought to a Sunday in Christmastide. Now, in a year that Sunday has fallen, has given us a Christmas day, you know that at least two things will be true. One is that there will only be one other Sunday in Christmastide. And the other is that it will surely fall on New Year's Day. Now, there's a little bit of a built-in advantage to that fact for a preacher. When my old supervisor and mentor, Dr. Meyer, called and asked me if I would come to preach today, I knew pretty much immediately three things. One, he and all the staff wanted to be out of town on New Year's Day. Two, pretty much anybody who ventured out to church today would be pretty high on the scale of seriousness of purpose. And three, among you, I am sure, are at least a few getting a very good start on a New Year's resolution to go to church a little more often. Well, we are glad that you're here. And after all the frivolity of last night, I know myself to be among serious people here this morning. One of the great gifts of this gifted congregation is that it does its work of witness. It travels the journey of its path of faith here in the midst of a community of the mind. And that is never easy work. In the long history of our human quest for greater knowledge and deeper spirituality is richly furnished with the sad stories of those who tried in their own day somehow to join together the life of the mind and the life of faith, and usually found themselves completely on the outs with most of their contemporaries, who insisted on the superiority of one over the other. So this New Year's Day brings me yet another opportunity, which is the opportunity to preach to such a congregation. Because in the calendar of the church today, January 1st is always a particular feast with a peculiar name. The Feast of the Holy Name. It used to be called something else. Anybody remember what it used to be called? I went diving into the back dusty corners of the sacristy of the little church I serve now in Newton, and I found the card we used to put up on the hymn board for today before we changed the name. This is what it said. You can imagine why we changed the name. Hard enough getting men to come to church. The Feast of the Holy Name. We have arrived at the eighth day of Christmas, the day on which the little family we first encountered in the barn at the fearful moment of childbirth now comes, as their tradition has taught them, to give thanks for the gift of a healthy and viable baby. On this day, the little boy enters into his own religious tradition by being circumcised and by receiving a name. Jesus, God will save. The very few days we get in this Christmas season are days for reflecting on the ways in which God fully enters into our human lives by means of the Incarnation. This distinct claim of the Christian faith. Jesus is fully human, born in the usual way as all of us were, as vulnerable as any little child. He is a child raised by a human family in the usual way. He is taught a set of beliefs by his parents, as all of us are, whether our parents were religious or not. And like all the rest of us, he is given a name by which he will be known and by which he will know himself. All of this is to help us grasp as well as we can the idea that God has taken such concern for us So it has to have acted to come and live out this life of ours right alongside us. To leave nothing out. To live it fully. So that nothing of us will be out of the reach of God. That is the point of the Incarnation. And it is the message of this season of Christmas. Okay, all of that is pretty straightforward. But with it comes something kind of odd. For years and years, going back about 500 years at least that I can find, together with this story of Luke about the eighth day and the naming of the child, on this day, January 1st, it has always been that the church appoints Psalm 8 to be read, not just because of the coincidence of the number. Over the past year, I have been spending a lot of time with the book of Psalms. And it's funny, if you think about it, the book of Psalms is the one book of the Bible that we read whenever we gather for worship. Here in this church, in any synagogue. We read a lot of things from the Bible, but the one book we always read when we gather is the book of Psalms. Yet, we do not often pay too much to the words of the Psalms. Psalm 8 is broadly categorized as one of the songs of praise. It's the first song of praise. There are 40 of them in the Bible. And in it is the verse I have taken for my text. The verse, I think, helps us to understand something more about the full meaning of the Incarnation. It's a verse that has a kind of permanent existence among us and in this community. Because for more than 100 years, it has adorned the door of Emerson Hall, just across the yard, the home of the philosophy department. And it is a verse that poses a question that must always be near the very center of a community of faith that lives and does its work in the midst of a community of the mind. I've used a more inclusive version of the text than the one you'll find on Emerson Hall, one I found in the translation of the Psalms done by the nuns of the Order of St. Helena. What are we that you should be mindful of us? Mere mortals, that you should seek us out. For the last 3 years, I have been working at something that I never expected to do. I have been working in a behavioral science laboratory. My closest colleagues are experimental scientists. I work with researchers from across the schools of the university who are working to understand more accurately, or at least a little more predictably, the workings of the human mind, and especially how we approach the inevitable task of making decisions. Now, the Decision Science Laboratory is an interesting place, and it does a lot of interesting things, but it is not a center for theological reflection. Which is part of the reason why, even 3 years after beginning my work there, I still go to work every day a little bit surprised at what I am doing. But the more I learn from my colleagues about the findings of their research, the more I learn from them about the peculiarities of how the human mind navigates across the landscape of decision, the more I am struck by the very real theological significance of the work they do. Let me say a little bit about what I mean. We have a basic way of dividing human existence, one that our Christian tradition helped mightily to contribute to the Western cultural development, going all the way back to St. Paul. We have understood ourselves as having both reason and emotion, the respective domains of the mind and the heart. And there has always been a profound moral significance to that basic division in our nature. Christianity picked up from Greek philosophy the idea that our gift of reason, the functioning of our rational mind, was what brought us closer to our higher selves. Our theological assertion was that our capacity for reason, linked to our capacity for free will, was exactly what gave meaning to our claim that we were made in the image and likeness of God. To say it in a phrase of Dorothy Sayers, the 20th century writer and theologian. Our minds are the mind of the Maker. The human mind is itself somehow expressive of that which is divine about us. The life of emotions, of passions, of the body's appetites, all of that was some other, some lesser dimension of human life. And it wasn't just that reason and emotion were two distinct natures in us. For centuries, the Christian idea was that they lived in active opposition. The only way for us to achieve our higher capacity to come closer to the divine that was in us was to overmaster our emotional lives as much as we possibly could. St. Paul is abundantly clear on this point. The passions, the appetites, the whole welter of our emotional experience was bound to get us into trouble. And the path to spiritual greatness lay through the discipline of perfecting our minds. But there is a problem with that idea. A problem that my colleagues at the laboratory study every day. And that problem presents at least two basic challenges, I think, to our theological thinking that we will need to take up seriously in the years ahead. The first is that it turns out not to be possible to separate our reason from our emotion. Said in other words, there are no Mr. Spocks among us. There is no perfectly rational human. Even the idea of emotional detachment is itself a kind of emotional influence on our thinking. We know this because we can show our emotional lives shape our reasoning and our decision-making in ways that are predictable and at the same time are invisible to us when we are the person making the decision. We can show that emotions that really should have nothing at all to do with a given choice before us, emotions that are incidental to the task at hand, turn out to shape the way that we see the problem and make our choice. In the lab, we can study some of the reasons for this with very precise tools. It has to do with our neuroendocrine system and the way that it leaves traces of earlier experiences long into the day, into the week even, of the life that we have and the choices that we face. Now, look, all of us are different when it comes to how aware or unaware we are of our emotional lives. But my colleagues have shown again and again that pretty much all of us have the experience of having our decisions shaped by our emotions in ways that we're not really that aware of. Sad people predictably spend more money. Angry people predictably take more risks. And no one ever feels that an emotion that they've been made to feel has anything to do at all with the choices that they've made, even though the evidence makes it very clear that it has. Here is the point for theology. We have been made as whole beings. And even though we learned this ideal about the perfection of our minds, we cannot disentangle our reason and our emotions, our minds and our hearts. To do that, to make them into adversaries, is to turn us against ourselves. We have lived with an ideology that sets one above the other. But as Professor Nussbaum has written, it may be that by trying to put one above the other, we have cut off part of our built-in equipment for making moral choices. Here's the second problem. Even if we could somehow separate our emotion and our reason, even if we could somehow separate our minds from our hearts, our reason itself is imperfect. In fact, it is predictably imperfect. Now remember, the idea of the earliest Christian teachers was that by perfecting our rational selves, we could more closely attain the divine in ourselves. The problem is, our reason turns out not to be perfectible. Dan Kahneman spent a long and fruitful career exploring the boundedness of our rationality, and he's summarized that career in a new book called Thinking Fast and Slow, which if you were very good last year, you might have gotten for Christmas. Seen from our own theological perspective, that's a problem, because it implies a kind of upper limit on our own aspirations for spirituality. Maybe even on the possibility of salvation, as though God has set on us a kind of limit before reaching a standard that we can't possibly attain. This is the work that my colleagues do that I find the most fraught and the most challenging from a Christian perspective, because the basic theme of it is to make clear again and again how very frail we are in the business of making moral choices. What the lab teaches us are some of the ways in which the imperfections of our reason happen in readily predictable ways. We make incredibly quick judgments of each other within the fraction of a second. We ascribe qualities to each other. We associate moral characteristics to other people based mostly on their facial structures before we've even met them. We will listen to new information that supports ideas we already believe are true, but we will often fail to hear the information that might help us to know those ideas are wrong. We are much more likely to regard any given moral transgression harshly when someone else commits it than we are when we commit the same fault ourselves. Our status in any given context, in any relative sense, our status is inversely related to our ability to perceive accurately the emotional life of one other human being. And my friends, this is a place of very high status. We love creativity in this institution. We value the creative mind, but it turns out the more creative we are, the more likely we are to be dishonest as well. And my favorite recent finding, one fit for the year we have just begun, election season. We think we join together with people and groups around political ideals because we have shared values. And it turns out that it might have much more to do with our pheromones. All those people in the Tea Party, they just like the way each other smells. Now, none of this is predictive, is determinately predictive about you or me or any one individual. But the work of the lab makes it possible for us to observe these behaviors as predictable patterns across populations of people. Our individual idiosyncrasies add up to a clear picture of humankind. We are frail creatures. And even that thing about us that has seemed so marvelous, our capacity for reason, even that is itself a pretty limited and regularly flawed quality. What are we that you are mindful of us, mere mortals, that you should seek us out? Here, in this community of faith, set within a community of the mind, I want to suggest that the idea of God's mindfulness might help give us a newer and a broader understanding of God's purpose in the incarnation. Maybe one way of seeing the point of the incarnation is to see it as the fullest expression of God's keeping us in mind, of God being fully present to our whole selves and not just a holy goal at the end of our rational road. We have been kept in mind by God in the incarnation, at least in the sense that we have not been forgotten. We've not been abandoned to our flaws and our faults and our predictable mistakes. We have not been put out of mind because of our proven ability to fall short of the glory God intended for us. But even more, we have been kept in mind in the sense that our whole human experience has been comprehended in the life of Jesus. Think about it for a minute. The Jesus of the Gospels is also not a Mr. Spock. The Gospel tells us that he lives a pretty vivid emotional life. He feels compassion on the crowds. He gets frustrated with his disciples. He weeps at the death of his friend. He gets angry at people, even in church. Maybe God has kept us in mind, come among us as one vulnerable and frail, to remind us of our own frailty, our own vulnerability, and our own need for genuine humility. Maybe our way of understanding the message of the incarnation, our way of grasping the Christmas message in a new way, can start by seeing Jesus as fully human, not merely a perfect mind, but a whole person who has come to make us whole people. To give us not just the chance of reconciliation with God, but a means of integrity, of putting ourselves together, a path toward our restoration to wholeness, to holiness, the way that God intended us to be. There's an old story about how, when Emerson Hall was being built, the philosophy department was consulted about the quote they would like to see over the door. And after the requisite time for committee meetings, an answer was sent back to the president. And the quote they wanted was that great line of Protagoras: man is the measure of all things. Well, Mr. Lowell, who was the president at the time, apparently had different ideas, and when the building was built and the wraps were taken off, there it was. What is man that thou art mindful of him? Psalm 8. Well, Mr. Lowell may have decided on the quote, but I think it would be pretty hard to argue that that line from Protagoras does not more accurately describe the general ethos of most scholarly endeavor today. The great gift of this gifted community is to do the work of witness, to do the travel of the journey of faith in a community of the mind. And maybe, just maybe, the great task of this community is to proclaim in such a place the idea that God has been mindful of us, has come among us to share our weakness and redeem every last bit of our existence, exactly because we cannot save ourselves by our minds alone. Maybe the task given to us by the Incarnation is to witness in this community of the mind the truth that true excellence requires whole people, and the hope that in this place, this great and gifted place, we can encourage in a new way that hope of whole human flourishing. Let us pray. O Lord, in remembering us, you have come to live among us. You know how busy we must be in the new year before us. If we forget thee, do not thou forget us, and bring us each day more fully to be the people you have created for yourself. Amen.